fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, we've got that Friday feeling today. It's so good to be with you on the Cale Clark Show today as we kick off the weekend. It's the 12th of April, 2024. Here's some other numbers for you. The phone number, 888-914-9149. You can use that number toll-free to call and talk to me. 888-914-9149. It's our listener line on the Cale Clark Show, sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Life Insurance. And, of course, you can also find me on social media on the X app, the X / Twitter app, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And you can email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E. Yeah, I had to think about how to spell my name for a second. It's been a long week. At relevantradio.com. Not Cale with a K. Not Cale with a K. Thankfully, it's Cale with a C. Although, no one was eating that stuff when I was a kid. It's only now recently become a problem for me. Consider changing my name to arugula. I don't think that's so popular still. But no, we're going to stick with Cale, and hopefully you'll stick with me for this hour. We've got lots to talk about today, of course, on this Friday. We've got the week that was coming up. Can't wait to share that with you. It's been an epic week. Just some incredible guests in particular this week on the Cale Clark Show. Got all that for you, packaged by our producer, Jim. But I want to start off with this. Actually, a listener sent me a really interesting link, and I encourage you guys to do so as well. You can email me, cale@relevantradio.com. Send me a link, become a shadow producer. And this was about C.S. Lewis. Now, I don't know if you guys are fans of the writings of C.S. Lewis, but he is one of my absolute favorites. He was so key in my faith journey, and I'm sure that's true for many of you as well. Incredible apologist in the 20th century. He was not Catholic, and a lot of people always scratch their heads about why he never became Catholic formally. He believed a lot of Catholic stuff, though. He really did. C.S. Lewis's real name, of course, was Clive Staples Lewis. He was born in 1898, died in 1963 on the same day as President John F. Kennedy when he was assassinated, and Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, and Peter Kraft, great philosopher, great friend of the program as well, once wrote a book. I think it was called Between Heaven and Earth. And it was an imaginary conversation in the afterlife between C.S. Lewis, John F. Kennedy, and Aldous Huxley. But he was an intellectual giant, Clive Staples Lewis, and an incredibly influential writer and incredibly influential Christian apologist as well. Now, his day job was he was actually a fellow and tutor in English literature at Oxford University in the UK, obviously one of the world's most famous institutions. And he held that position up until 1954. And then he was unanimously elected to the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. And of course, the great rivalry between Oxford and Cambridge. And he held that position until he retired. He wrote more than 30 books. And his books are still widely read to this day. You probably heard of three major motion pictures that are based on his Chronicles of Narnia fantasy series. The Chronicles of Narnia. All right, anyways, those Narnia books have sold over 100 million copies. They've become a franchise unto themselves. And he also wrote some other fantasy works, such as Out of the Silent Planet, all kinds of science fiction. Of course, The Great Divorce, The Screwtape Letters, really, really practical satire, theological book that became super, super popular in the 20th century, especially in the United States. And it's really it's about a senior demon named Screwtape, who's instructing his nephew, who's this junior demon. He doesn't know what he's doing. His name is Wormwood. And it's all about how to tempt this guy who they've been assigned to try to make sure that he doesn't get to heaven. He's known as the patient. How do we get this guy to disbelieve in God? How do we get this guy to fall prey to temptation? It's an incredible book. If you've read it, you know what I'm talking about. Maybe that's your favorite C.S. Lewis book, but I'd love to hear what yours is. 888-914-9149. The one that was really influential for me was Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity, which actually started off as a series of radio talks that he gave during the Second World War, which became, of course, the book Mere Christianity. And so he really has brought a lot of people to faith in Christ, really answered a lot of questions that I had. But in particular, He became super popular among Catholics in the United States. Catholics really got his message. They really understood C.S. Lewis before almost anybody else. And I think it's because of certain things that Lewis wrote about. And producer Jim, do you have a clip of Lewis? Okay, great. Can you set the... On the problem of being good, is this from the radio talks that eventually became Mere Christianity? Okay, well, it's going to be good. Let's listen to this. This is C.S. Lewis.
The Christian life is simply a process of having your natural self changed into a Christ self. And that this process goes on very far inside. One's most private wishes, one's point of view are the things that have to be changed. That's why unbelievers complain that Christianity is a very selfish religion. Isn't it very selfish? Even morbid, they say, to be always bothering about the inside of your own soul, instead of thinking of humanity. Now, what would an NCO say to a soldier who had a dirty rifle and, when told to clean it, replied, "But, Sergeant, isn't it very selfish, even morbid, to be always bothering about the inside of your own rifle, instead of thinking of the United Nations?" Well, we needn't bother about what the NCO would actually say. You see the point? The man's not going to be much use to the United Nations if his rifle isn't fit to shoot with. In the same way, people who are still acting from their old natural selves won't do much real permanent good to other people.
Okay, so that's the voice of C.S. Lewis himself. I love the organ music in the background, too. It's very much like Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy. That's interesting. Maybe I should play organ music in the background during the show. Maybe not. I don't know. It's probably a bad idea. But it's always a good idea to hear from C.S. Lewis. It's always a good idea to read the writings of C.S. Lewis. They're super practical. And I got to confess, confession time here. I have not read the Chronicles of Narnia. I know. My daughter, Michaela, is probably incredibly disappointed listening to the show right now. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I've seen the films. I haven't read Lord of the Rings either. I know, I'm just losing all kinds of street cred here, but I have read the theological stuff from C.S. Lewis. That's kind of what I'm into. I'm not much of a fiction guy anymore. I should get back into fiction. But having said that, I was sent by a listener an incredible article that was written by Professor Mark Knoll. He's a pretty famous history professor. He taught at Wheaton College in Illinois for many years, also the University of Notre Dame. And he wrote a series of really intriguing books. One of them was called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And the big joke was, there isn't one. That's not entirely true, but it's just a little attempted humor. But Mark Knoll, I remember hearing him speak during my years in Protestantism when I was at an evangelical seminary. And he came in to address students and faculty, and I was really impressed by this guy. He also wrote a book about the history of Christianity in North America. And one of the things that he said was the Catholic Church in Quebec in the 1950s, that time period in Quebec, Canada, he called it the most Christianized place that had ever been seen on the face of the earth, because everybody went to Mass every Sunday. The church was ubiquitous. But what's interesting, too, is that the faith is, in one generation, everything completely fell apart. If you've been to Quebec, and maybe you have, Father Rocky, every year he goes on a pilgrimage to the Oratory of St. Joseph, which was built by St. Brother Andre in Montreal. And spoiler alert, it's not the most beautiful church in the world. There's some really weird 1970s stuff on the inside, which is really tragic because it's so historical. For my money, I'd go to, you got to go to St. Joseph's, but also make sure you make a stop if you ever go to Montreal. You got to go to Notre Dame. You got to go. It's really gothic. It's incredible. That's where Celine Dion got married, if you remember that. Anyways, I digress. But most of the churches are empty on Sundays. It's just completely fallen apart. It's become almost incredibly and totally secular. And how did it fall apart in one generation? Well, a good priest friend of mine, Father Eric Nicolai, hails from Montreal, and he said, "I don't think it was ever really Christian in the first place. It was only apparently Christian. On the surface only, and just one little crack and it all fell apart." That's an interesting perspective. But anyways, Mark Knoll is a fine, fine historian, and he had written this article in the Ad Fontes Journal called Lewis Takes Manhattan. And it's really all about why Americans in particular, they kind of got St. Lewis, St. Louis. Hopefully he's canonized. It will be one day. Praise in heaven. C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis. That's what I'm talking about. C.S. Producer Jim is a big, he's from St. Louis. He probably liked that little slip. But C.S. Lewis, why was it Americans glommed onto him? And specifically Catholic Americans really loved his writings. And why did they resonate with the Catholic mind? Well, Mark Knoll says that in December of 1935, it was the first American book review of anything written by C.S. Lewis, which appeared in the New York Times. It was about a book that he wrote called The Pilgrim's Regress. You might have heard of the famous book, The Pilgrim's Progress. Well, Pilgrim's Regress is an allegory by Lewis all about how Christianity really meets the needs of the human person on a personal level, on an intellectual level, far better than any alternative that's out there in the market. It just coheres with reality, which is very important. This is called verisimilitude. It's a key fitting into a lock. It just makes sense. And that makes sense. If God is real, if he set up the world, if he created us, and if Christ is real, he really redeemed us. He knows how this whole life project should really work. Well, after that, 1935, that was a glowing review in the New York Times. And then in 1947, 12 years later, he was on the cover, C.S. Lewis was, of Time magazine, which of course was the best-selling magazine in America back then. And so it wrote about another book of his called Miracles, and it was wow, this is an amazing book. And so this is all of this happened before the first Narnia tale came out in 1950. It's before Mere Christianity came out in 1952. And of course, he gave these talks on the radio. They eventually became the book Mere Christianity. And that's really when he became a worldwide household name. But it's really intriguing why American Catholics in particular really got Lewis. So Mark Knoll says a lot of stuff in his article. But he said that, quote, Catholic readers of C.S. Lewis provided the fullest, most learned, and most appreciative audience. Protestant reviewers, while mainly positive, engaged with fewer of his works. Evangelical Protestants, who are now among the most enthusiastic Lewis devotees, trailed mainline Protestants in coming to appreciate the Oxford Dawn, end of quote. What's your favorite C.S. Lewis book? Has he influenced your faith journey? 888-914-9149. All right. So what about Catholics and C.S. Lewis? Well, Thomas Merton, and there's another guy that I have to confess to you, I know who he is, of course. I have not read The Seven Story Mountain. I know Merton is controversial in many ways. But very famous convert to Catholicism, was baptized as a Catholic, eventually became a Trappist monk in Kentucky. And Thomas Merton reviewed C.S. Lewis in 1939, a book called The Personal Heresy. And Thomas Merton really actually loved C.S. Lewis's work, and they got a lot of attention. His books got a lot of attention in other Catholic periodicals. And Catholics were the only ones in America who wrote about all of the books of C.S. Lewis. There were 17 books at that time, and nobody else wrote about all of his books except for Catholics. And some of them, the Catholic reviewers were critical of how he looked at the idea of church, which isn't that surprising because he wasn't Catholic. But one professor he actually taught at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, Charles Brady, who lived from, no relation to Tom Brady, 1912 to 1995, but he quarterbacked the faculty, if you will, at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York. And he wrote some articles in America, which is, of course, the weekly journal that came out weekly at the time, sponsored by American Jesuits. And he talked about Lewis's academic writing on literature, especially Milton, and how that kind of got into his more popular works like the Screwtape Letters. And actually, Charles Brady, Professor Brady, said that the Screwtape Letters was, quote, the most phenomenally popular household book of applied religion in the 20th century, end of quote. It's true. It's applied religion. It's super practical. If you read the book, it's a great meditation on what the enemy might be thinking of, how to take you down. And I know Patrick Alog, who's working the phones for us tonight, 888-914-9149, he says Screwtape Letters is his favorite C.S. Lewis book, and he's shocked Patrick is shocked that I have not read The Chronicles of Narnia or The Lord of the Rings. Well, I have seen the movies, so I guess that counts for something, maybe not much. But at any rate, yeah, Screwtape Letters is a phenomenal book. And he also said this, Charles Brady, this Catholic professor, said that C.S. Lewis is the only truly popular champion of orthodoxy in book, in pamphlets, in radio addresses since the passing of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. So, wow, he's basically saying, like, he's the greatest writer and defender of the faith since the late G.K. Chesterton. That's very high praise. And obviously the two of them are really very much in the same vein, G.K.C. and C.S. Lewis. CSL and GKC, I guess you could say. Not AOC, but anyways, all right. Alphabet soup, let's get out of that. But having said that, Brady was super, super fond of his works. Now, what was it specifically, I think, that made Catholics really interested in what he said? Well, not only was his writing very clear and very understandable and very accessible by so many different people, one of the things that he did on a theological level was that he really focused, and he does this especially in Mere Christianity, he talks a lot about objective morality, about something like that right and wrong really do exist. There is something as right, there are things that are truly morally wrong, and this is a key to understanding the universe and the meaning of life. And in fact, that goes all the way back to St. Thomas Aquinas, but C.S. Lewis made this really, really accessible to a popular audience. And I'm going to talk to you about how he's able to reach a lot of skeptical people and maybe why he didn't become Catholic right after this break on the Cale Clark Show. And you can call in 888-914-9149. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. They're a pro-life phone company, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to Relevant Radio or another pro-life charity of your choice. For a limited time, new customers who mention offer code Relevant Radio get a free phone with free activation and free shipping. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Welcome back. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We're talking about C.S. Lewis and why Americans kind of got him maybe before the rest of the world really did, and especially Catholic Americans. They really appreciated his work, even though he himself wasn't Catholic. There are some reasons why he didn't become Catholic, even though he believed a lot of Catholic stuff. We'll get into that in just a bit. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Kevin. Let's go to the phones right now. Kevin is in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing fantastic. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I just wanted to call because C.S. Lewis was just one of my favorite authors when I was in high school. And I really went down a rabbit hole of books like Dante's Inferno and Paradise Lost and The Screwtape Letters. And I think all of those kind of fulfill a void that the Bible sort of has, in that they don't really give a character to the devil. The Bible doesn't, you know, you have the adversary, there's the serpent in the garden, there's the tempter with Jesus in the desert, but it isn't until these, you know, quite frankly, fan fiction type books are written that they really give the devil a personality, an intelligence that just is deeper than what I think the Bible had to offer. And it's definitely addictive and intriguing. And, you know, Catholicism really pushes the presence of the devil in tempting us. And it just doesn't feel as real. But once you connect to this fiction, maybe it just, I don't know, becomes part of your subconscious, you know, that now there's a personality to this, you know, fallen angel.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he's a preternatural intelligence, supernatural intelligence. Even though he's fallen, a fallen angel, he's still smarter than all of us in the world put together. And I think what's intriguing about what you're saying, Kevin, is I liken it to something that a guest on the show this week, Professor Mike Ryall, we were talking about artificial intelligence and human flourishing, but he's training game theory. And one of the things he says about game theory is that you really have to put yourself in your opponent's shoes and what are they thinking? What do you think their next move is going to be? And I think that's really the genius of the Screwtape Letters, to think about how the enemy is trying to take us down. And of course, the word Satan is, it's actually a Persian loan word into Hebrew, which means opponent. And whether you're into WWE, even though that's fake, this is real combat. This is mortal combat. This is more like UFC. I mean, this guy really wants to take you out and for all eternity. And so we have to be wise to his schemes. That's what the New Testament tells us to do, not to be unaware of the schemes of the devil, the wickedness and the snares of the devil. We've got to pray. That's what part of the St. Michael the Archangel prayer, that we might be protected from the wickedness and snares of the devil, because there are many traps laid for us. There's no question about it. So I think it's just a different way to look at things. And I think it obviously it was something that really, really worked for people and hopefully made them more spiritually aware. They need to pay attention here, because again, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world that he doesn't exist. That's a line from The Usual Suspects, great movie. And it's true, though. It's true. And we have to be wise to his schemes. So, Kevin, thank you so much for calling. God bless you. Kevin in Cincinnati, Ohio. Great phone call. Great phone call. All right, let's go to Rich in Redwood City, California. No Cal. Hi, Rich.
Hey, hi. How you doing? Okay. I just told your screener that C.S. Lewis loved the music of Richard Wagner, you know.
Hmm.
The Ring Cycle, the Ring of the Nibelung, the Ring of the Nibelungen. Well, he was an admirer of Wagner. He loved his music. And Wagner's known to have been very contemptuous of Catholicism.
Hmm.
So I think C.S. Lewis probably had a similar opinion of Catholicism, I'm afraid. So, but I just thought that he was teaching Judeo-Christian religion, not Catholicism, or I think Christianity is too much a reflection of Catholicism. I don't think he agreed with it.
Well,
Wagner described Catholicism as having operated a slaughterhouse for the use of the priests. I mean, that's a direct quote.
Well, that's an interesting angle with Wagner. If he was a fan of Wagner's music, I don't know whether that played into any of that or not. And I wouldn't say that Lewis was anti-Catholic. And by the way, Catholicism is Christianity. Of course, it's original Christianity, and it is in the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. It's not a separate entity from Christianity. I don't think he was anti-Catholic in the way that some others have been throughout the centuries. I do think he had some misunderstandings about Catholicism. And I think that there's actually an explanation for that might be simpler than we think. And actually that kind of, thank you for calling, Rich. I appreciate that. That leads us into our next call. Dee Dee is with us once again from Phoenix. Hello, Dee Dee.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, welcome back.
Well, thank you. Well, I love C.S. Lewis,
mm-hmm.
and I love Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were buddies.
Yes.
And Tolkien, of course, who was Catholic, asked him, why haven't you converted to Catholicism? And C.S. Lewis' answer was Belfast, Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. He grew up in Ireland, Northern Ireland.
Yep.
And historically, the Protestants have been fighting the Catholics there like forever.
Yeah.
You know the politics, the history of Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why, and there's a slang term that Tolkien used, and even historians used. The slang term is, the question always is about C.S. Lewis, why he never poped up, P-O-P-E-D, meaning the Pope. The Catholic
right.
Pope, because of the violence he experienced as a young man. And that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, Dee Dee, I think you're right. I think that actually is the reason. And I remember having, thank you for your call, Dee Dee, appreciate you. I actually had dinner one night. My wife and I had dinner at the home of a man who wrote a biography of C.S. Lewis, also wrote one of H.G. Wells. And he told me the same thing. He thinks that he just could not overcome the anti-Catholic biases of his upbringing in Ireland. And in fact, J.R.R. Tolkien, who you mentioned, and they were very, very good friends, and Tolkien helped him to embrace Christianity in general. He actually said he had an Ulsterian motive, ulterior motive. There we go. An ulterior motive. Ulster, of course, in Ireland. Okay, you get it. Instead of an ulterior motive. And he just couldn't get over that. Because when you look at the writings of C.S. Lewis, although he never did become a Catholic, he was so Catholic friendly. He believed in Eucharistic realism, even though they don't have a valid Eucharist in the Anglican Church. Eucharistic realism and a male ministerial priesthood. He believed in confession to a priest, and he actually went to confession to an Anglican priest on a regular basis, again, even though they don't have valid holy orders, but he believed in a lot of Catholic stuff. And so people often ask the question, you know, why didn't he actually become a Catholic? But I think that is exactly why, because of the roots of his background growing up in Northern Ireland. And so when he wrote Mere Christianity, just to get back to this question of one of the reasons why Catholics appreciated him so much is not just that stuff, but when he wrote Mere Christianity, it brought up a really, really important argument about the moral law. And of course, for us Catholics, and other Christians aren't so big into this as we are, the idea of a natural law, a natural moral law in the universe is really, really something that it's a big part of our belief system. The other stuff that's in Mere Christianity, and again, he was trying to be a generalist. He was trying to have a broad-based appeal, and he was very successful in that because Protestants read him, Catholics read him, Orthodox Christians read him as well. It's and this whole thing about the basics. What is Mere Christianity? How many items constitute the basics? Who gets to decide this? How long is the list? Those are really good questions. But what he does say in Mere Christianity is proffers a whole bunch of arguments that all Christians can use, including us Catholics. But let's just talk about the whole issue of the moral law thing. I wrote an article about this a few years ago. One of the things he says, it's a bit of an off-topic statement in Mere Christianity, but he says this, quote, "Everyone has heard people quarreling. Everyone has heard people fighting, essentially." You're listening to the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. You can call in if you have a take on this. So C.S. Lewis says, everyone has heard people having a fight. If you haven't been in an argument yourself, you've heard people quarreling. And he gives examples of things that people say when they feel like they've been mistreated by somebody else. How would you like it if someone did the same to you? Or, come on, you promised. And this is what he says about that. C.S. Lewis says, quote, "What interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He's appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, 'To heck with your standard.'" Now, he said another word instead of heck, but I'm sanitizing it. I don't know if I need to, but "the other man very seldom replies, 'To heck with your standard.'" So this is a really intriguing argument. So when somebody does something that the other party says is not fair, they'll say, "That's not fair. That's not up to the standard of behavior that you should know about." But nobody says, "Hey, who cares about your standard?" Now, he said that back in the 1940s. And at this point, if you're living in the 21st century, you might say, well, such an argument might have worked back then during World War II, but the objection, "To heck with your standard," that's exactly what the average man or woman on the street might say today, because we live now in a different culture. Pope Benedict the 16th very famously dubbed the situation that we're in right now, he called it the dictatorship of relativism. The dictatorship of relativism. this concept out there that there is no truth. There is no objective universal truth that applies to everyone. It doesn't exist. That's the dictatorship of relativism. Because if you don't believe that, we're going to persecute you. That's the dictatorship part of it. So when somebody says there is no truth, there is no overarching moral truth, that the irony is, of course, that itself is a truth statement. We just can't get away from this idea of truth, can we? So I don't know if people see the irony when they say that there is no objective truth. That they think that that's true, obviously. We can't get away from truth. The reality is that nobody actually lives that way. Nobody actually lives in a relativistic way. The late Tim Keller, who is another influential Protestant Christian, he was a Presbyterian pastor in New York City, recently passed away, very, very contemporary, was very, very successful in converting millennials and people in their 20s and 30s in New York City, professionals, young professionals, getting them to look into Christianity and accept it. So the late Tim Keller said this in his book, The Reason for God. I'm going to quote Tim Keller here. He said, quote, "Conservative writers and speakers are constantly complaining that the young people of our culture are relativistic and amoral. As a pastor in Manhattan, I've been neck deep in sophisticated 20-somethings for almost two decades, and I have not found this to be the case. The secular young adults that I have known have a very finely honed sense of right and wrong. There are many things happening in the world that evoke their moral outrage." End of quote. And that's true. We see this among young people, and they're, I think, in many ways misguided in a lot of ways, but a lot of the campus protests that happen over various issues are nonetheless born of this desire for righteousness. And they may be misguided in that, but nonetheless, they are morally outraged. Whether they should be or not is another story. But don't forget, now you might say that C.S. Lewis didn't know about the dictatorship of relativism when he was writing back in the 1940s and doing these talks that became the book Mere Christianity, but he was well aware of moral relativism in 1940s England as well, because don't forget that before these ideas ever get down to the popular level, to street level, to you and I, it starts off in the ivory tower. It's like the top of a mountain. The snow melts at the top of the mountain and it trickles down and fertilizes the valley below. But these ideas were already being talked about. Remember, he taught at Oxford. He taught at Cambridge. So he knew about these ideas. His fellow academics were talking about this stuff all the time. And in fact, he wrote this in Mere Christianity as well. And he's probably thinking about some of his academic colleagues. He said, quote, "The most remarkable thing is this. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find this same man going back on this just a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining, it's not fair, before you can say Jack Robinson. A nation may say treaties do not matter, but then the next minute they spoil their case by saying the particular treaty they want to break was an unfair one. But if treaties do not matter, and if there is no such thing as right and wrong, in other words, if there is no law of nature, and he capitalizes law of nature, what is the difference between a fair treaty and an unfair one? Have they not let the cat out of the bag and shown that whenever they say, whatever they say, they really know that the law of nature exists just like anyone else?" That's such a good point. So if there is no such thing as universal right and wrong, you can't even say that something's fair or not fair. You've let the cat out of the bag. You do believe in such a thing. He says, "It seems then we are forced to believe in a real right and wrong." So what's the ultimate point? What's the ultimate point of all this that we're trying to talk about here? Well, C.S. Lewis wants his audience really to understand three things, three facts. Number one, there is a universal moral law, and that applies to everyone. Now, whether or not people explicitly believe such a thing, whether they say they believe such a thing, they appeal to it all the time. They always complain they're the victim when someone else doesn't obey this universal law of right and wrong. Oh, this isn't fair. You know, there are court cases. You know, all these things happen, right? Attempting to excuse themselves when they don't obey it, it happens all the time as well. And that leads us to Lewis's next point. So this is point number two. So point number one, there is a universal moral law that applies to everyone. Number two, all of us are breakers of this moral law. we have been breakers of this moral law, or we will be breakers of this moral law. We, in other words, we all sin. We all miss the mark. We've all been guilty of breaking this universal law of right and wrong. Only people who are totally delusional or who never examine their conscience would deny this. And unfortunately, we do have a lot of people who never do a good examination of conscience. That's why the confession lineup is so short. I'm fine. I'm not a sinner. I haven't killed anyone. So people are completely delusional about this. I think that is the case for sure. So there is a universal moral law, number one. Number two, all of us have either broken it in the past, we're breaking it now, or we will break it in the future. And number three, the existence of this universal moral law strongly implies a moral law giver. Where does the moral law come from? Where does this come from? Now, we would say it comes from God, but we're a million miles away from that theological argument right now. Lewis says, we're not yet within 100 miles of the God of Christian theology. You still got to provide evidence for the Judeo-Christian concept of God, the divinity of Christ. I think that's where Easter comes into play, Easter apologetics, but it's a starting point. It's a starting point. I think this is one potential road that you can start off with people who are secular in getting them to think about the God question, the existence of the universal moral law of right and wrong. Now, people, like, in their own minds, before they discover the objective moral law and they know more about it, they still believe in it. And they might draw the line at different places in their own life. But most people would say it's wrong to, say, pull out an AK-47 and start shooting up a school. Most people say that's wrong, that's evil. But people will say, oh, certain other things may be, that might be okay, taking a couple pens from the office or something like that. But everybody draws a line somewhere. That's the point I'm trying to say. And everyone believes in this concept of fairness, whether they admit that or not. So this is a good starting point, I think. And that's why I think Lewis led off Mere Christianity with that argument. And it can help us, too, in our dealings with people who are not professed believers in Jesus Christ. They're not Catholics. But we can talk to them about ultimate reality, that there is a universal moral law. It really does exist. And that moral law strongly implies a moral lawgiver. It strongly implies the existence of someone, not something, but someone we would call God. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show. Would love your reaction to this. 888-914-9149. We'll be right back.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program on this Friday. It's the final segment. We've got a special surprise for you right now. But you can call in. Don't forget, you can call in if you want to react to any of the stuff we've been talking about. C.S. Lewis and the argument from the moral law. Incredible stuff from the great apologist. A lot of Catholics love his work. He's so Catholic-friendly. Even though he never did overcome those anti-Catholic biases of his youth, he never did enter the Church of Rome. But we need to pray for the repose of his soul. We can never forget that. You know, he knows now. He knows what the truth is now, that's for sure. And we need to pay heed to it as well. 888-914-9149. Well, it's Friday. You know what that means. Producer Jim, along with an assist from Miranda Sinceros, has produced for you The Week That Was on the Cale Clark Show. Let's roll it.
Our guest, archaeologist and Holy Land guide, George Sue Steffen. I want to go into the buildings. You talked, George, that it was underground, that Christians had to worship there in the beginning.
When St. Helena came here in the 4th century to build these churches, there was a church that was built on the spot where Mary lived, where the Archangel Gabriel lived. So that was a continuous thing that was running, of course, underground and not above the ground. That what I love about a Basilica of the Annunciation is that the moment you walk in the modern church, the new basilica, you'll be able to see the one that was built in the 1960s, our time. You'll be able to see parts of the Crusader church. If you go further a little bit, you'll be able to see, you see the stages, the 4th century and 5th century octagon church building, built by, of course, the Byzantines.
My guest today is Professor Mike Ryle. I want to ask you about something that you've said. These large language models like ChatGPT, they're only going to get better. But one thing that they will never be able to acquire is a human-like intelligence. One of the things you've said is that intelligence does not equal an inner life.
So when we think about human flourishing, you know, in our tradition, human flourishing means recognizing that you're a child of God and embracing God's mission, whatever that may be. What humans seem to have uniquely is the ability to conceptualize. You know, to really be banging on all cylinders as a human being, we must develop that capacity not only to do what's best for us, but we're really exhibiting that capacity if we can actually help others flourish. And so in order to do that, we need knowledge, we need to know what's true, we need to have wisdom, you know, we need to have prudence. So we need all of those sort of classical cognitive capacities in order to really flourish as human beings.
Let's get into some picks right now. Let's start with producer Jim.
My pick to win the Masters is Colin Morikawa.
Colin Morikawa. I'm always tempted to pick Morikawa for majors as well. He's such a great iron player, such a great ball striker, multiple major winner already. Patrick Alog.
My winner pick, it's going to finally happen for him. Rory McIlroy.
Well, I'll tell you who I think is going to win this year. I can't go against Scottie Scheffler, the number one golfer in the world right now. As a ball striker, I don't think anybody can touch him on planet Earth right now. He did win in 2022, so I'm going with Scottie to win. I want to welcome to the program Maria Ruiz Scapperlanda. Something that, again, most listeners probably haven't heard of. It's to do with something called the Duck Massacre. So here's the clip from the Mary Beggar series on Blessed Stanley Rother.
God, what do you want from me?
This is my husband, Padre.
Yes, I'm here next to you. Are you here, Jesus? Help me, please.
What a powerful thing for him to just simply stand next to the women as they went up to claim their loved one that had been laying there and dead. Just to walk with them, just to be there, to be the presence right next to them.
Wow, an incredibly powerful week on the Cale Clark Show. If you missed any of these episodes, you're going to want to check them on the relevant radio app. You can download, listen to the podcast, and share it with a friend. Also heard the voice of Brooke Taylor, who filled in for me so admirably on Monday. Thank you so much, Brooke. And right now, I want to bring in Patrick Alog. It's time for a Masters update. Let's see how our picks are doing. I've had my nose to the grindstone today. I have not checked. Going to watch tonight, hopefully. But let's play that nice Augusta music from Dave Loggins. Did we ever find out if he's related to Kenny
you
Loggins,
ask that, You
way?
Say this every year, Kale. I think you said it in 2022. You said it in 2023. Yes, he is the cousin. You might as well just say it next year, too.
A tradition
unlike any other, right? Asking if Dave Loggins is the relative of Kenny Loggins.
Yeah, I have a great memory, but it's short. Anyways, how are our picks? Well, first of all, just tell me what the leaderboard is doing right now. What's going on right now,
there's actually a three-way tie. Max Homa and Bryson DeChambeau both at 6-under, and wow, your winner pick, Scottie Scheffler, currently at 6-under as well. Wow. He's still playing on the course, though. So he could definitely be solo lead or drop off the lead, depending on what happens the rest of the day here.
Yeah, absolutely. And Max Homa was playing with Tiger Woods today.
Yes, he was.
How is Tiger doing?
Tiger's going to make the cut for the 24th time in a row, breaks a record for most consecutive cuts made.
Yeah, which he shared with Gary Player and who else?
Fred Couples. And he said that he's going to tease his good friend Fred Couples about breaking his record.
Oh, he's going to give him the needle for sure. Tiger loves that stuff. Absolutely. Okay. Now, you'd pick Rory to win.
Has he
created any roars on the course today?
Where Tiger is tied for 37th. Should make the cut. He's not done with his round yet. But
okay.
So, I mean, yeah, 7 shots behind, maybe.
It's not impossible.
But he's going to have to do a lot of work tomorrow to have a shot on Sunday.
Yeah, he is a streaky player, though, at times, and he could make a charge. We'll see what happens. And Gary Woodland, that very touching story that we had shared earlier in the week, he had received brain surgery, mm-hmm, to take a lesion out of his brain, a husband, a dad. He had to write letters to his kids and to his wife in case this surgery doesn't work out, in case I don't make it. Here's how much I love you. And we forgot to mention that he actually aced.
He had an ace
in the par 3 contest next day. So,
and unfortunately, that was probably the highlight of his week because he is 85th and right near the bottom of the leaderboard.
Oh, gee. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm sure he's not unhappy, though, because he's just glad to be here after all he's been through, and what a blessing it is. And by the way, you know all about holes in one. You're the Relevant Radio. You're the only one at Relevant Radio who I know has actually made a hole in one.
I think there's a I think Lee Dupre, who's in engineering, has hit a couple of hole in ones. He told me
a couple.
As well.
Wow. Lee's a pretty truthful guy. He's a pretty solid guy. So I do believe that. Some other characters, I wouldn't necessarily believe they told me that.
And I'm at this point in my playing career in golf where I'm going to try to hit another hole in one. There's no playing it safe on a par three. It's not like I'm playing in a tournament and
you
I need safe
it.
Strokes. I'm always going to go for a hole in one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the round's on you if you make it, that's for sure. All right, what about Jim's picks?
Oh, and then your other pick, by the way, your sleeper pick.
He's asleep.
Tagala. Tied for 37th as well, plus one. So.
Oh, okay. Because he was running really badly this morning. Yeah. I heard he was like plus three or four, and
so
I thought,
he made a run.
He's out of it. So he's kind of, okay. Sleeper pick, I thought he was not just asleep, but like asleep in the biblical sense. I thought he was dead out of the water, but... But he's okay. He's okay. All right. And Jim and pick Colin Morikawa.
He's fifth right now.
Well, okay. Morikawa.
He is minus three. He is three behind.
It's a second shot golf course, Augusta National. You have to be a good iron player like Morikawa. And Charles Schwartzel.
Near the bottom as well. Not as bad as Gary Woodland, but 81st.
Okay. So he's not going to make the cut, unfortunately. But he has a green jacket. He can always come back every year, no matter what. Now, here's a quiz for you, Patrick.
Maybe Jim might know, too.
Jim might know too. Scottie Scheffler, he's 27 years old right now, and I think he's very mature and wise for his years. Talked about his faith in the Lord earlier at the press conference this week. How many major championships does he have right now at the age of 27?
Oh, Scottie Scheffler?
Yeah.
Oh, he has one.
He just has one.
Yes.
Here's a question for you. How many major championships did Tiger Woods have when he was 27?
It was, I believe, if I do my math, he had... let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think 6.
8.
8.
Isn't that incredible? Eight. Like, I mean, Scotty Scheffler's amazing. Tiger had 8 majors by the time he was 27, and that's including like a lull where he made a huge swing change after he won his first major in the 97 Masters, had rehauled his swing with Butch Harmon, didn't win another one until the 1999 PGA at Medina number 3. In Chicago. How about that? One of the great golf courses in the world. Well, thanks for that Masters update, Patrick. And we'll see, of course, who is the owner of the green jacket when we meet again on Monday. But let's go to the phones right now. Let's go to Jack in Germantown, New York. Hello, Jack.
How you doing, Cale?
Doing great.
I just really, and I'm a big C.S. Lewis fan, and I saw you sort of touching this on some of your other Mere Christianities, but I don't know if you ever read the book The Abolition of Man, but it's really worth reading because it talks about, you know, these ideas of relativism, moral relativism, and the dangers of it, and the book was written in 1942 before the Second World War was decided. It was a series of lectures that he gave, but it's a very short book, and a Catholic priest is like, I forget the guy's name, but he wrote a book called After Humanity, which is
we had him on the show, Jack.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh,
you know what, I'm going to ask producer Jim if he can find this episode in the archives, and we'll put it in the show notes, because it's Father Michael Ward.
That's
Father
right,
Michael Ward. Yeah, and you're correct, Jack. And first of all, it's great that you're a C.S. Lewis fan, because that was his nickname, of course, Jack. So your name is Jack as well, so that's very appropriate. And no, Abolition of Man is an incredible book. And yeah, the book that you mentioned by Father Michael Ward, Catholic priest, is kind of a commentary on the abolition of man. It's called After Humanity. That's also a great book. And he was an incredible guest. We had him on the show. It was a phenomenal interview. I learned so much from this. And yeah, Jack, that book mentions this concept, the abolition of man, is of men without chests, which is such an arresting image. Jack? Oh, you're still there. Okay, good. We lost you for a second there, Jack. So did you hear what I said there?
Yes, men without chests. And the other thing I said, apes with trousers, basically, is another line that he uses. But it's all about... You know, your metaphor of the mountain melting and ideas coming and fertilizing the valleys, well, that he takes apart a high school textbook where in English, evaluating poetry, and I think it has something to do with describing a waterfall as being sublime versus pretty, and this sort of minimalism that's so associated with it, and a word like sublime is more. But I really think that that book points toward so much of what he wrote points toward Catholicism. This idea of natural law. You're exactly right. Anyway.
It's such a great point. Such a great phone call, Jack. I really appreciate that. And actually, the book, it's funny that you mentioned the waterfall, because the book After Humanity, the book jacket cover, it has this incredible photo of a waterfall, and that's referencing that as well. So, yeah, that's another great work of C.S. Lewis that people should read, The Abolition of Man. And, yeah, that's just why we have to do an apostate with people who are shapers of culture, with those whose ideas influence others, teachers, in the academy. We got to reach the people who are up and out as well as down and out, because those ideas eventually get to the masses. And so, as Father Rocky likes to say, we need to bring the masses to the mass. And that's what it's all about, bringing them to Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. Well, Father will be along later with the Family Rosary Across America. But first, it's Trending with Timory coming up next here on Relevant Radio. I'm Cale Clark. Thanks so much for listening this week. Check the podcast. Jim Shaper produced. Patrick Aloch took your phone calls. Enjoy this weekend. Enjoy the Masters. But get in touch with the Master, our Lord Jesus Christ. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.